Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show, live from Laguna Beach, California. Welcome, all the guys and gals down at Tantalk Radio, 1340 AM, making us the voice of Tampa Bay in Florida. Tonight's guests are going to be Jin and Sunflower from the Source family, which is a trip that I was involved with. I wasn't exactly a member of the family, but I had a lot of great times, and we're going to talk about that with, as everybody says, that lived in that time, it, regardless of how long you live, that's the year or two or 5 years that stands out most in your life. It was started by a person by the name of Jim Baker, known later as Father Yod, who I met several times. And next week's guest is David Icke. So welcome, Jin. Are you there?
I'm here, Dr. Fred.
And Sunflower, are you there?
I'm here, there, and everywhere.
All right. Yeah. Sunflower and I are in common because we're both pilots. Are you still flying, or did you quit a long time ago?
I'm flying, but I learned how to do it without an airplane these days.
Well, that's good. That's what everybody, that's all my listeners want to do it without an airplane. So anyway, we're going to have to go back in time, and I just want to say one of my experiences before we start about the history of the Source. Back in 1971, or 1972, I was sitting in there, out there on the patio, like I always did, getting my Aware salad. And I was wearing my pyramid. You guys might remember the pyramid that I wore. You may or may not wear it. I wore it up there a lot in those days. Actually, I didn't wear it in 71. It would have been 73, I think, I had it on. And this girl came up to me and put her head on my lap. And I looked down at her, and she says, "I want to know who you are." And I says, "I'm Dr. Fred. Who are you?" And she says, "My name is Michelle Pfeiffer, and I really like that pyramid on your head." And that's the way the Source restaurant was. It was an actual in crowd. John Lennon, everybody was there at one point in time. Marlon Brando. So I have just a little background on my experiences, and I had many of them from about the late 60s, like 69 on up when they started the thing. So one of you guys talk about how the Source came about and what it was so the listeners can understand this before we go too far into the details?
Hey, go ahead, Sunflower.
Okay, the Source restaurant was an outcropping of the days from Yogi Bhajan, when Jim Baker was with Yogi Bhajan and was doing a lot of Kundalini yoga, and that's how he kind of basically got started in his path to enlightenment. So he was a restaurateur on the Sunset Strip and had a couple of restaurants previous. However, there was a need for a vegetarian restaurant where everybody could go, and everybody in the whole entire yogic movement and the meditation movement could go and have organic foods. So it started off, his concept originally was he was going to call it the salad bowl, and then when he started hooking up with a lot of the more conscious people, we changed the name to the Source Restaurant.
And the food when there was incredible.
Well, you know, originally that building, it's really amazing. They say out of the lotus, out of the mud, the lotus grows. And that building originally was, right before Jim Baker took it over and created the Source, it was occupied by motorcycle gangs that basically when you ordered your food, they would bring your meat to the table and cook it with a blowtorch.
Wow. So, yeah, you went to the other end of the spectrum.
The bikes used to line up all the way down the strip, and then when that went out of business, the building became available, and so out of the mud, the lotus grew.
Yeah, that's amazing. And tell us, I know Jim Baker was a Marine war hero. He was a martial artist. Tell us a little bit about him before he went through this transition to becoming a God consciousness figure.
Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, well, you knew him better than I did going back then, but... yeah, he was in World War II, and he was a decorated hero. Came back from the war, and he started a gymnasium in Cincinnati. They had a big fanfare for him there, and he produced a world champion boxer named Ezard Charles. He was a heavyweight champion, and Jim Baker got asked to be the first Tarzan, from what we understand, because he had long hair and he had the physique, and he went out to Hollywood from Cincinnati, and he didn't get the role because he cut his hair for some reason. But he was quite a figure. He did a lot of major human type of things that we would consider human, superhuman, I mean.
Yeah, superhuman, definitely. He was quite a guy.
Yeah,
he had a heck of a booming voice too. I remember that.
Yeah, he had one of those Marine sergeant voices.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. It was amazing. So anyhow, when I came up there, I ended up moving up 2401 Laurel Canyon in Frank Zappa's old house. That was in 74, about the time you guys were not there anymore, selling the source. But I used to live in Long Beach before that, and I used to come up there and eat and then go over to the Whiskey A Go-Go, which was down the street.
Oh.
And I noticed, you know, tell us about some of the celebrities. I know Tony Curtis wrote some notes. I mean, there was always, nobody ever noticed they were, it's like New York, you know, New York, everybody hangs out with everybody, celebrities included. But that place, I mean, that was like the, you know.
Well, this is Sunflower again. And
yeah.
Let me tell you, there were many celebrities who used to fly into Los Angeles, and the minute they got off the airplane, they would take their limousine and come to the Source restaurant, because it not only served the best and the highest kind of organic food that you could buy, but the energy in the place and the vibration was so high that it was almost healing to come in there from the worlds that these folks had been living in, you know, of chaos and confusion, and come in there to start their journey through Los Angeles in the best possible manner they could find.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was really amazing. And I guess, you know, looking back in the history of Jim Baker, I mean, he came from like a bunch of pioneers, didn't he? Mountain men and stuff like that.
His lineage was Jim Baker, the mountain man, who was also one of the most famous pioneers of the United States. And he was a very similar lifetime after lifetime, I guess, through the lineage of his parents and grandparents. It was his opportunity this lifetime to be a person who could exhibit his tremendous power and understanding of pioneering, so to speak.
Yeah, and then I guess before he started the Source, he made sandals and he was making shoes for a while. And this guy, he reminds me in that era of that guy that was, you know, on the Superman movie, the guy that was the with the beard and everything, that guy that was the opposition to Superman, that good-looking, big, bad guy, you know. He had that kind of a charisma. I mean, it was real interesting. But I mean, he did everything. And, you know, the other thing was, you know, he hung out with Gypsy Boots. Gypsy Boots was an old friend of mine for many years. Was Gypsy coming up there to the Source in those days a lot with that? They were
Gypsy used to supply the Source with all of his goodies. Whenever he had a van full of stuff, he'd pull up in the back and unload a lot of it for us. We got all of our dates from him, and we got a lot of fruits and vegetables from him.
Yeah. He wasn't pushing Kylik yet, right? Garlic?
Yeah, Kylik.
Gypsy traveled with us on the National Health Federation for a number of years before he passed over, and he was just an amazing guy. The guy just didn't change at all, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens when you eat organic and fresh foods. They give you life instead of take life from you.
Yeah. I hung out a lot with Dick Gregory, too. I don't know if he ever came up there much, but I knew him back in New York after he left Lafton, you know.
Yeah,
and
profound vegetarian.
Yeah. I was a vegetarian in those days as well.
Well, Gypsy and Jim were part of the Nature Boys.
Yeah, exactly. And Jack LaLanne.
Jack LaLanne, Gypsy Boots, Maximilian.
Yeah, this was like, to me, you know, L.A. was always known as the, you know, the grassroots of the holistic movement. And I think these guys were the original pioneers of all of it.
Yeah.
And I used to go out, you know, I liked the Wear Inn, too. I remember when he opened that up, I used to go upstairs, and you could do things up there that were really cool while you're waiting for your food. And then when he opened the Old World, I used to hang out over there a lot. That was a really cool place, too. So he was quite a restaurateur, you know.
Well, both of those restaurants, they serve traditional foods.
Yeah.
Not in a traditional way.
Yeah.
And he even believed in eating organic in those days. And even the meat, he would serve, he had one dish at the Aware Inn where they called steak tartare, which is raw beef. And he always said that it was not necessarily the meat itself that was terribly harmful to you, even though you shouldn't eat another sentient being.
Yeah.
But it was the chemicals and the poisons that were injected into the animals prior to them being slaughtered, and in the manners that they were slaughtered, which was made it very prohibitive to continue to eat that way.
Yeah, no, I agree. Because the cow is freaking out, the adrenaline rush, they've been raised on steroids practically.
Well, they take animals and they shoot them with diacetylbestrol before they take them to the marketplace for the last month. And what it does is it adds about 200 pounds on them.
Wow.
In a month. And they just, they plump up and they get nice and fat. So I think that when humans eat that meat, they're getting the same thing happening to them, and it's pretty obvious what's going on with the human race today.
Yeah, because immediately, you know, the cholesterol levels shoot through the roof. Even if you're not prone to have high cholesterol levels if you eat meat now, I'm scared to death of it. I've been a vegetarian for a long time. Yeah.
Hey.
Are you there, Jen?
Yeah.
Oh, good. That's so anyway, back in those times, you know, now I don't know, Jen didn't know about him, but in those days, actually there was a friend of mine that was similar to Jim Baker. His name was Sarinjava Roy, and he lived up in San Francisco. And he lived up in Haight-Ashbury, and he got the trip going up there. He wasn't quite the same energy. He came over from India. But in those days, people, I think the vibration was higher. And in the incarnations of people that came in that time were really into the higher, you know, there was like a door open to another dimension.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's there anymore, but I think that those of us that lived through that time, that was a brilliant time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a time that I'll never forget. I mean, it's like Jim Baker said, Father God said, you know, you'll remember this time. You know, if I live to be 100, what year will stand out in those years in that era? I mean,
yeah.
that just, it jumps out like, because it was the feeling, the release, the freedom that we all got
mm-hmm.
in those days, you know?
Well, I remember a time when there was no less than 30,000, what you would call hippies, hanging out on the Sunset Strip every single night.
Right.
And when you have that many people that are aware and conscious and free of spirit to come together, it's a kind of a thing that it's still hard, it's still you can still find it today, but not like that, you know, the movement is diminished considerably.
Just think, you know, I don't mean to interrupt you, but just think if our society today could have, you know, we could bring him back and clone him 10,000 times and put him in charge of every business in the world, what a different society we'd have.
Absolutely.
We wouldn't have Effexor, we wouldn't have Valium, we wouldn't have all these, you know, Xanax. They didn't exist. I mean, they wouldn't exist because, first of all, tell my listeners, you know, what happened at 3 o'clock in the morning. Tell them about your life working there. It wasn't just a job; it was an event. Explain the disciplines you guys had. It was tremendous.
Well, we were up at some of us. Most of us were up by 3:30. We met at 4 in the morning, and at 3:30, as soon as you opened your eyes, your first exhale of breath was the sacred name Yehoah, which wasn't just Jim Baker's final name, but it represented the Hebrew letters are called Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, pronounced Yehoah. And it represents a universal code rather than a name, and it's very profound what it can do for your intellect in understanding that name. So that was the first exhale in the morning, and then we'd lift our legs up while we're in the prone position, 6 inches above the bed, and we'd point our fingers towards our toes, and we'd do a breath of fire, like a fast breath, like this.
Right. I know that one well.
That was 108 breaths,
yeah.
And that took about a minute. And then, that was called setting your solar plexus, because that's where the pressure, the stress point, or the fulcrum point when you lifted your feet up and you aimed your fingers at your toes.
So you did the fire breath while your legs were elevated?
Yes.
Ooh, I've always done it sitting down. I want to try that. That sounds great.
It is great. And
yeah.
Then you spring out of bed and go straight into the cold shower.
Wow.
No talking all morning till meditation began.
Wow.
Till the class began.
Yeah, you can imagine we had probably, at some points, we had over 200 people living together. And at 3:30 in the morning, 200 people are scurrying around doing breath of fire and cold showers. And
and no talking.
No talking.
That's brilliant. What a brilliant man.
No talking.
Teach you guys that. That is good. That's better than the temples in India, you know.
Yeah.
That's a discipline.
Yeah.
And how long did your meditation last?
It varied. We it always began at 4, and usually he'd put us through Well, it changed a bit with Father from Father Yod to Yehoah, but mainly Father Yod was really the, you know, the spiritual drill sergeant that got us in shape. But so that when I'm talking, you know, about this stuff, it's mainly the Father Yod period.
Right.
We would meditate. He would have something come through him. He'd put us through some yoga positions and some breathing techniques, and then we would partake of the sacred herb, which isn't a secret anymore, so I can tell everybody
that.
Yeah,
it's fine. Everybody likes that. No,
yeah.
You guys did it. You didn't OD on it. You didn't go around boozing and drunk.
No, I want to explain that.
Yeah, explain all that. People need to hear that.
Yeah, that we were not a drug-oriented, though there's a lot of rumors about us.
I know you weren't. I was there.
Yeah, we were far from a drug-oriented, but because many people came from our culture with a lot of habits, which we definitely eliminated.
You're right.
We had a 6-second inhale per person, and it wasn't mandatory that you take the sacred herb. You know, some did, some didn't. But those who wanted it only would get a 6-second inhale, and actually, you know, that's quite a bit, so a lot of people didn't even do that, but that was the max.
Yeah.
And that had to last all day, and it was at meditation, just before meditation. And if you wanted to reactivate that THC, we just did what we called a star exercise, which again included the breath of fire. And the oxygen just, because the THC stays in your blood for up to a month, and so you can reactivate it at different degrees according to these breath techniques. And so that was all you had of that. And then we would do a lot of chanting of that name, Yodevahe, Yehoah. And then usually something came through him, and he just started channeling, and it was always something pertinent to our, you know, our soul's elevation of our soul consciousness. And then as the sun began to rise later in the morning, this would go on for about 2 hours. So we're at about like 6 in the morning now, and the sun would begin to rise. It seemed like, you know, the earth trip would start to come in, and he'd start talking about certain, you know, physical daily routine things that that needed to be addressed. And sometimes, which is how the music was created, well, most of the music was created at 4 in the morning. There were times when he would just say, let's go into the band room at, Yehoah 13. Let's go in and lay something down. I feel like there's something there. And so we'd go into the band room, and it would be all set up, and then we'd start playing.
Yeah.
And we had speakers that ran through the house, so a lot of the people that wanted to could stay in the other rooms of the place, and then we could be in the recording studio recording. And altogether, we recorded in the morning, we recorded over 65 spontaneous albums, which some of them were cut on vinyl and put out for sale. And a lot of this stuff never did really get mass-produced and put out. But we had 13 albums that were produced and over 65 that were recorded.
Yeah, the music is fabulous. Go ahead and give out I've had this on the front page of the BBS radio, but give out the website that they can order this music from. It's fabulous music. And Jen, by the way, was a guitar player. Sunflower, do you play music or...
Yeah, I'm the bass player on all the albums.
So I got both of you guys the music. Okay, fine. So give them the address of where they can get some of this music. What's the website?
It's yehoah.org, yehowha.org.
Yeah. I highly recommend you get this music. And do you guys still do some of these disciplines that you learned a long time ago?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, most of the music that we did with Yehoah 13 was a spontaneous creation. We never knew what we were going to do. We would just go in and catch a riff and work with it. And so we don't necessarily do that kind of...
I'm not talking about the music. I know that, but I'm talking about the disciplines of yoga and that, you know, the fire breathing.
Yeah, that's all a part of. That's all a basic part of all of our lives. Still, once you achieve a certain level of understanding what this will do for you, it would be silly to go back and not do it.
I agree. I've been fire breathing since I was 27.
There are people that go out and spend hundreds of dollars on drugs to get what you the kind of feeling that doesn't even come close to what you can have for free.
Exactly. I know. I totally agree. And I know you guys heard no alcohol in the source until it got sold, which was much later on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I remember when you added the little higher key music section.
Right.
On the outside of the building. That
right.
was really
cool. I built that little section out there originally as a jewelry store.
Yeah.
And to sell my creations. And then when the music started happening, we sold the music out of that side office to the restaurant, which is still there.
Wow. And then who made those medallions you guys wore? Remember, there's different.
Sunflower.
There's a belt buckle.
Belt buckles. Yeah, this is sunflower. I made all the belt. Belts.
Wow.
Yeah, those belts were comprised of silver, tin, and gold.
Wow.
And there was a process by which they were all made. I think I made about 60 of them.
Wow, they were beautiful.
They have the symbol of wisdom on them. The symbol of Mercury. So they represent a lot of wisdom there, solidifying at your solar plexus.
I still got mine.
Yeah, I need to get one of those. Where do I buy one of those?
Yeah.
I can get Sunflower to make me one, huh?
You can.
So then, anyway.
Possible.
Yeah, so, and tell us about, you guys had so many cool people coming in there as client, a restaurant, like, I know Marlon Brando would come, I mean, it was amazing the clientele that place had.
We had George Harrison, Captain and Tennille, the Earth, Wind, and Fire.
George Harrison would come continuously, and John Lennon, and they would park their limos in the parking lot, and we'd take their food out to their limos. They'd sit in their limo with the light on and eat in there sometimes when the restaurant was real busy. They didn't need to wait in line there.
No, you didn't have to. I remember I had a Black Mark IV, and I used to get mad because I'd always polish it up, Lincoln, and I'd drive in that parking lot, and before you guys paved it, I got my car all dirty. But
yeah,
I didn't care, you know.
Yeah. Well, in the early days, the restaurant didn't make a lot of money in the early days, but when it started to make money, all the improvements went back into the restaurant, and it turned out that we finally had it all pretty much dialed in with the paving and everything.
Yeah, it was a palace when you guys got done with it. It really was.
That restaurant supported over 200 people continuously, and it did make a considerable amount of money, but that's a lot of money to support that many people. Jim Baker never took a dime for himself.
Yeah.
Everything was to support the family and the adventures of the family.
And I know for a fact that, he had a couple of people that would make his meals for him, and if he saw a brother or somebody that was hungry, he'd just say, give that meal to that person.
Oh, yeah.
And he would go hungry.
Oh, yeah. That was certainly his style.
Yeah, yeah.
Annie Hall was filmed there.
Yeah. So then you guys got the music, and then that one guy, I know you guys are going to be doing a concert. I mean, it's coming up. I think it's the guy from the Seeds. I mean, I was talking to Jen about this. It's coming up pretty soon out there in the valley, right?
Well, it's going to be
It's actually at a club called the Echoplex.
Yeah.
And we're going to play on the 14th and the 15th.
No, 16th.
The 16th.
At the Echoplex in Silver Lake.
Yep. And what is that this month?
November.
November, okay.
Yeah.
Is there room for more people, or is it sold out, or what's happening there?
Oh, there's room.
Yeah, because I know that guy, was his name Saxon?
Yes, Guy Saxon. He was in the family.
Yeah, okay, and he was a singer for the Seeds. He had a band called the Seeds.
Yeah, he's going to have the Seeds there.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
Yeah.
So that's...
The Seeds are going to perform, and then Yehovah 13 is going to perform. So it's going to be quite a show. We'd love to have everybody come out.
Yeah, so what you guys need to do is email me all the information. I'll put it up on the BBS Radio website next week, and then we'll all meet out there,
Great. Yeah,
absolutely. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah. And then I remember he bought his first Rolls Royce, and that was like the Chariot, right?
That was the Chariot. That was a white Rolls Royce, and it had white interior with red piping around the seats.
That was a beautiful car.
We paid $35,000 for that Rolls Royce, and it was the Chariot, and it had the YHVH license plate. And one of the brothers, there was only one brother that was allowed to drive it, because so he was the chauffeur. And anybody that needed to go anywhere or do anything in the Rolls Royce, it was there for them to use. You could use it, but with 200 people, it would be a little difficult to have the responsibility not assigned to one or two people to take care of the vehicle.
Yeah, so everybody got to ride around the Rolls Royce at one point or another.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool in those days. Now, I've got a Rolls Royce now, a 79, which is the same body style as the one that he has. And that thing is worth as much as he paid for that one back then, brand new.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Well, it was a lot of money back then. We're
yeah.
We're talking 1972 or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, he and the band would roll up to a number of gigs in it.
Yeah, and it would get the attention of everybody.
It would get the attention, yeah.
And, you know, now the other thing about these God-conscious guys like Father, which there aren't that many around, Father Yod, as I knew him, is that every day, you know, I always tell myself and people around me, you know, say you're having a crappy day today, tomorrow's a brand new world. And I know for a fact that I don't know if you call them miracles or not, but out of nowhere, stuff would happen that was totally unbelievable. And if you told the stories today, you know, in the situations that would happen spontaneously, people still probably wouldn't get a handle on it, because everybody's living in the truth, you know, in the clear truth, and that's when things happen.
Yeah.
And you're not living a lie.
Well, I think everybody would like to see somebody come to this planet and perform a bunch of miracles.
Yeah.
A lot of people followed miracle makers from India, you know, that
yeah.
make sawdust come out of a bowl, whatever.
Yeah.
So most of the masses don't have the ability to get up and be able to perform those miracles themselves. So they look for somebody else to do it for him. So he would not do miracles so that he could have a bunch of followers.
No, I understand. He didn't like devotees at all.
Yeah,
I know
yeah.
the story of the Krishna people that came to buy the place when he put it up for sale, which we'll get to in a minute. But I mean, things would just happen. You know, something would need to be happening, and it would happen for that moment.
Yeah.
You guys remember that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. Well, every morning, you know, the reason we got up and we did what we did is because it would start off the day in a new way every morning.
Yeah.
And during those hours of the mornings are the times when the channels are the clearest, and you can tune into the ascending currents of universal life energy. And they're different every morning. And depending upon what the stars have to offer that morning is what kind of energy you're going to tune into. And if you do that every single morning, and you start your day in a new way every day.
Yeah. It's true. I've always believed that running a business like I do now, and I've had Paradigm for 32 years, which is a consciousness-raising, you know, device-making
right.
business, I still get caught up in the pragmatics. It's so easy. And somehow or other, you know, the discipline, like today I went out running across the mountaintops where I live here in Laguna. It was really necessary for me to do that. I haven't done it all week, should do it every day, because I wanted to do this show with you guys. I know you guys are going to be clear. I want to make sure I could get somewhere near your vibratory level.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. But I mean, that's the kind of stuff that. So finally, as the family grew, I know that he decided to go to Hawaii, right? And you guys started to move off to Kauai, the Garden Island.
Now, well, we needed a place where the women and the children and the young ones could be free and happy to, you know, grow our own food, live the perfect utopian lifestyle. You know, so we searched through the Hawaiian Islands to find a place that we could do that, and we did find 14 acres in Kauai. And so we sent out some scouts, and we managed to procure the land, and little by little we all moved into Kauai. And Kauai at that time, back in the 60s, was kind of a primitive place. It's not the same Kauai that you have today.
Oh, I know. The Kapaa Airport in those days was like a shed. Now it's an international airport on Kauai.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the people in Kauai really didn't fully understand this very much. And they, you know, especially since the Manson thing was still fresh in everybody's mind.
Yeah.
It was not really advantageous for us to stay there forever, because we weren't fully welcomed, and we wanted to be in a place where we could be welcomed. And as you know, in Kauai is where we started our fishing business.
Right, and that's where you were the spotter plane, right?
Yeah, I'd fly the plane and the...
What kind of plane did you have, by the way?
Well, I was just a Cessna 150, but it was good enough to get off the ground.
Oh, yeah, those are great. That's, you know, that's the second plane I ever flew in my... You know, a great little airplane.
That's
yeah.
a fun plane. Well, on Kauai, you know, we learned how to fly from bush pilots. At that time, there was no radio-controlled tower at the Lihue Airport.
Oh, wow.
And the big jets would come in and land, and the little small planes would have to. You'd have to tune your radio to a certain frequency to be able to talk to the big planes and stay out of their way.
Wow. That's interesting. So where'd you guys fish? All the different shores or north, south? Which part of the island did you go for? All around or what?
We lived in a town called Kapa'a, and we had 14 acres there.
Yeah. So you were down there, were just, let's say it would be north of Lihue a little bit.
Yes, north of Lihue. But at the time, even Princeville wasn't even very much developed. There was just starting out there with the developments, and it was all fairly primitive. Anything past Kapa'a was pretty well primitive out there.
Wow. That's the glory days for Hawaii, I guess.
It was pretty nice.
Yeah. So you guys stayed there for a little while, and I know it was I know how those people are. They're even, you know, I go over there to Princeville a lot now, and they're the Hawaiians, especially the ones that are Oriental background types. They're a little uptight over there, you know.
Well, in all fairness, I want to say that I live on the Big Island now, and the Big Island is not that way.
Yeah.
People here on the Big Island are some of the most wonderful people in the world. They had a good reason to be a little bit uptight. You know, they were ripped off for their lands and everything else. And, you know, the people came in from the mainland, took full advantage of everything that they had to offer. So over a period of time, you know, with the sugar canes and all the rest of it, they were a little upset with what had happened to their pristine lands. However, those kinds of things have calmed down a little bit now, and especially here on the Big Island, it's so big and there's so much space that people here are really beautiful. So I just want to clarify that.
Yeah, no, I could relate. I have a friend of mine. He was one of my clients. He was from Maui. And he became a friend of mine 25 years ago. His name is Kolani English. And he moved over to the Oahu. And was, I think he went to school at the University of Hawaii. But he became an attorney and an elder. And he was working on the succession of Hawaii from the United States. They wanted their land back because they all got screwed. You know, the Hawaiians theoretically own that land. And then when the other people came in and started buying it, they were really selling something that wasn't even theirs. And that was a big, I know that was a big problem. I don't know how you say it's settling down now?
Well, it's settling down. However, there are still are these cases coming up now in the Supreme Court where they're finally coming to the surface where the judges and the law enforcement people at the time, way back when, absolutely just claimed the land and took it away from them. And this is land that went back families upon families upon families, and this is land where they had buried their dead for years, you know, and it's no longer theirs. So it's all starting to get sorted out now, and of course that's another subject that's going to get us off track here if we're not careful.
Yeah, no, I know that. And what part of, you live in Hilo?
I live in on the north shore, which is the Hamakua coast.
Oh, okay. I didn't know quite where you were. I did some music with George Winston on Hilo and at Uncle Billy's. I had my DAT deck, and when I was working on an album, we did some recording in there. It was one of the original Hawaiian vibration hotels, which is really cool, you know. I love the native stuff. And I also know in the family that a lot of people were highly skilled people in there. I mean, there wasn't just a bunch of people. You were talking about people that, I guess today some of them are land moguls and, you know, they run big businesses, but even then, a lot of people gave up a lot. You know, I know the group up that was Electricity or somebody in San Francisco, you know, when he joined, he gave up his business and he sold his home, and a lot of people gave up a lot of things to get into this energy, didn't they?
Yeah, we had one sister in the family. She's her name's Lovely.
Yeah.
She was Andre Previn's daughter.
Yeah.
One of the brothers in the family, he passed away about a year ago. His name is Ajax. He was a advisor to President Eisenhower.
Right.
Isis, who wrote the book on the Source family, she was involved with some of the political people in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and then, you know, that's the point of where I'm bringing that up is that this is not a bunch of
mindless
lost people. These were some, you guys were a very disciplined bunch. Some of you, anyway, were.
Yeah.
And you guys are a lot of professionals here. We're not just talking about somebody looking for themselves out smoking dope on the corner. You guys were all highly skilled. And I know Sunflower, you're highly skilled. You do carpentry work? Who does the carpentry work a lot?
Actually, I did all the carpentry in those days in the family. I built a solid redwood temple with no nails and that kind of stuff.
Did you build that thing in the back with all those pegs in it behind the source?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I examined that one day. You know, I was over there, and somebody was telling me that, you know, one of the carpenters in the family built that thing. And this, I mean, we're talking no nails here. Nails are electromagnetic energy. You made a meditation
room. No, there was nothing. There were wooden hinges everywhere. The roof opened up with wooden hinges. And, it was, I built a lot of things in those days because I had the inspiration that Father gave me. To do these things, and I was really devoted to pleasing him and having him, you know, it was like when he would see the creations that I would make and they were finished, he would just marvel at it because, you know, he knew that they were conscious creations.
Yeah, how long did it take you to build that structure? That's where I first met him, was up in that loft back there. How long did it take you to make
that was originally, it was built on the ground, and it only was 2 feet up off the ground.
Right.
And then we needed some more space at the restaurant, so we cut the legs off of it and moved it over into the parking lot, and then we built a space underneath it and brought a crane in and raised it up and put it up above.
Yeah, I was in there. I went in there when it was up above.
Yeah.
But how long did it take you to build the actual structure with no nails and everything?
Well, it took me maybe about 4 months.
And that's all?
Yeah. But it was kind of interesting because the building inspector was driving by, and he goes, "What the heck is that?" And he comes driving in, and he gets out of his car, you know, and he walks through the thing, and he bumps his head on the because it was meant to sit in there and not walk through it, you know.
Right.
He would come in and sit down and meditate. So he bumps his head, everything else, and I had an exchange with him, something about it being a temple for God, and the guy never came back.
Wow.
No permit, no nothing. Just
yeah, we need to get you down here in Laguna Beach and teach these building inspectors what God is, you know, about carpentry. You'd be a winner down here.
Well, I now have gone on to build some fairly large buildings, and I'm building a $70 million project here in Hilo right now. And so I get to know the building inspectors very well.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what you do now. I mean, you have a construction company, or what do you?
No, I work for a very large firm, and one of our divisions is here in Hilo, out of Honolulu, and this is one of our biggest projects here.
Wow. And so you know, how with this background and this discipline inside of you, which you had most of your life now, how does that affect your working environment and the coworkers that you're working with over there? Does this rub off on them, or what happened?
It's a continuous merging of the opposites.
Yeah.
You know, but Father always taught that it was in the overcoming was the greatest amount of spirit. If you have a challenge and it comes to you and you cannot overcome it, then it wins. But if you have challenges and they come to you and you can overcome them, then there's the greatest spirit.
Yeah, that to me, that's the greatest reward, I would think.
Yeah. So
there is no greater reward.
I'm a builder, and I love to build. However, some of these challenges, you know, I have to call upon the sacred name to get through it.
Yeah, I can relate to that. That's funny. Yeah. So you're not flying anymore, I take it. You gave that up or what?
Well, I fly with my son now. It's very interesting. When my son was about 2 years old, I was on the Haleakala crater driving along the side of it, and we pulled the car over, and a couple of hang gliders came down off the mountain.
Wow.
And flew over the top of the car, and I said to myself, you know, someday I want to do that. I want to fly off the top of Haleakala.
Right.
And sure enough, 25 or years later, when my son was old enough, he took me flying off the top of Haleakala crater for my very first flying experience.
So you did it with a hang glider?
In a parasail.
Parasail. Yeah, those are cool.
Yeah. So he flies that continuously.
How old's your son now?
My son is 33.
You know, this is, you know what's so funny? I'm looking back at where we were in those days, and I was only like 30. You've got a son now that's 33.
Yes.
But it seems like yesterday.
Yes, it's been quite a journey, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been a journey. But if I flash back, you know, I talk about the Source Restaurant on all my shows, practically, about the things that people I met and what went on up there. So when those books came out and Jen came here to the house, it was like, well, where you been? You know, where you guys been? It's about time we reconnected, you know?
Yep.
you know, I wasn't immediate family, but I really respected the family, and I was one of your best clients, and I had a lot of fun with everybody, you know.
As soon as you said that to me, I knew you were family.
Yeah. Yeah. I you know, it's like, wow, you know. And so, Jen, where are you living now? You're up there in Northern California,
Mount
right?
Mount Shasta.
And you have a really amazing house. I guess you're going to sell, right?
Well, yeah. I got to emotionally let go of it before it's going to sell, I'm told.
Yeah, that's typical. Tell the listeners about the house and how it was built. It's kind of special.
Yeah, it is a special house. It was built in the mid-80s by a Buddhist monk.
Yeah.
His name was Reverend Chosi, and... there's an abbey up here. All the land that surrounds my house is still owned by the abbey, the monastery.
Wow,
and,
sacred ground. Sacred ground.
It is sacred ground, and all the wood that was used was old growth on their property here, and they milled it.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore.
No.
But the house is all handmade. There must have been, you know, they must have been praying with every saw cut they made, and because the inside is all open beam. Someone said it was like the houses in Bhutan, which I don't know what they look like, but that's what it reminded me. It's a solar passive house. He built it into the hillside.
Wow.
Facing south.
Wow.
Which is through the winter, the sun is in the south.
Sun's gonna set that way, yeah.
So we have that southern exposure is a wall of picture windows.
Right.
And a 6 foot by 3 foot picture windows. All open beam wood, and it's about three stories on the inside. The upper story is like the peak. So there's no attic, but it goes all the way up to that peak. And, it was going to be, actually, the monks were going to make it into a tofu factory.
Wow.
And they were all going to live there, so all the rooms are open. There's just like a partition wall or a wall that comes up a few feet, and then there's like window space going out to this rotunda, which is made out of entire rock so that the sun can come in and warm the rocks up in the winter, and so it's a very energy-efficient house. We don't use very much wood all winter.
Wow. And this is, what town is near where this is?
Well, we're on the border of Mount Shasta and Weed.
Okay, so
we're
actually
in Weed.
Yeah, so do you ever see the Lemurians come out of the mountain and pay things in pure gold or anything like that?
Well, we have a full view of the mountain from our house. Actually, I'm in the... There's a kind of a cauldron between Mount Eddy Range and Mount Shasta, and then in the center of that kind of cauldron is a cinder cone, which is quite large. It's a mountain in itself, but it's called Black Butte.
Right.
And we're at the base of it.
Wow.
And so I have a complete view of that whole basin from our house, and I can't say I've seen any Lemurians or Telosians.
Right.
However, I'm sure I've spoken to a few.
Oh, yeah.
I hear they're not, you know, they're not overt about it.
No, they're not.
You need to come to the Big Island for that.
But the energy around here is quite scintillating with presence.
Now, do you want to, is your house is for sale now or not?
It's going to be on the market. It is for sale, yes. It's going to be not on the market yet, but we're going to list it probably next week.
Do you want to give your phone number out if people are interested? Because I got people out there listening that might want that place. It's because it is.
It's a very special house. Yeah, my home phone number. Are you sure? I'll give my home phone number. I got good karma.
Yeah.
530-938-1583.
Yeah, repeat that one more time.
530-938-1583.
Because this will be archived too, and how much? What's going to be the asking price on this really cool place?
Well, we're trying to be fair about it, even though it's a special kind of a house with a lot of history and spiritual energy. We're going to ask about $425,000.
And how much land is around it?
2.5 acres.
Yeah, that's a fair price. I know that the places in Shasta are going up.
Yeah.
You know, they really are.
And our house tripled over the last 5 years.
Oh, I believe it.
And We have complete privacy. We can go nude here. There's plenty of room on our land for a corral if anyone wants horses. We have a garden in the back that's ready to go. We produce from it every year.
Right.
It's a beautiful place. It's a jewel. If somebody wanted a getaway place to write a book or a musical or something like that, do something creative, it would be really ideal.
Wow. Yeah, there's people that listen to my show that might be, you know, interested, and that's why I wanted to get this up in the archives. And Sunflower, where do you live on? You live near where you work, or?
Well, I live out on the Hamakua Coast, which is about 25 miles outside of Hilo. It's between Hilo and Kona, and it's really one of the most desirable spots on the whole entire island to be. And I have a 10-acre parcel out there, which is part of a parcel of close to 100 acres that I have with my son and a few other members of the family.
So some of the family is regathering now?
Well, yeah, and not in the same old way, but yes, we are. We've stayed in touch throughout the years, and everybody is still conscious and doing their practices, and we understand who we are, and everybody fits together well. However, we're not communally living. We believe that everyone has to contribute on their own levels to what they have to contribute, and so it's worked out good because everybody's become very self-sufficient over the years. So now we have the ability to come together and not have to support the weak, so to speak,
Yeah, no, I understand. It's just been a privilege, I know, to be part of what you guys were doing, and it's really, what are some of the interesting things that some of the other family members ended up doing after that intense experience in the late 60s, early 70s? Anything of note?
One of the brothers named Magus has been quite successful.
Uh-huh.
He established a business where he would farm computer workers, so that if there was a large company that needed, say, 1,500 computer programmers to come to work for them, he would supply them.
Wow!
And so he had a very big network.
Wow!
That he worked with. I think he's still doing that. I'm not really sure what he's doing, but there's been, I'd say, a great percentage of the family members have gone back into society and become very successful at whatever they do.
That's good.
It is good. When you consider that, you have to try and merge the world of spirit with the world down here. And Father always taught that the greatest spirit was in the material. And if you can master the material, then you have mastered spirit.
Yeah, I totally, totally agree with that. And that means master it does not mean become attached to it.
Become attached to it. Master it means to be able to function in it fully and completely without it telling you what it wants you to do.
And that's a big, big discipline. And that requires lots of fire breathing in my case.
Well, there are far too many people that claim to be spiritually devotees or whatever.
Yeah.
And they can't even earn $5 to put food on the table for their families. Things like that just never set very well with me. I mean, people need to understand that you can't just claim to be spiritual. You have to show it, you have to prove it, and you have to be it on all levels.
Yeah, you don't run around telling people what you're doing. You just do it and let them recognize you if they have the eyes and ears to see and hear. Yeah, I agree totally. Yeah, and it's amazing, what you guys were. You were really a band of brothers. And by the way, the other thing I remember, and we're running out of time, but I've been an archer all my life, and I know you guys were too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have a bunch of recurve bows around here. Did you guys get to do a lot of archery in those early days?
Yeah, we did a bit of it. We had, our target set up, and Father got a few of us into it.
Yeah. Were you into it?
I did a little of it, yeah. I guess... It hurt my fingers a little bit, and I had to play in the band.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good way out. You gotta get a 30-pound bow and wear those little leather things.
Yeah,
because you still play the bass?
Sunflower plays bass, yeah.
Yeah, you guys are still playing.
I still play the bass. As a matter of fact, I've been in bands over the years.
Yeah.
I was in a really fairly successful band in Los Angeles recently called Fortune Band.
Wow.
and the guys still have trouble replacing me since I've moved over to Hawaii.
Yeah.
I moved here a little over 2 years ago, but I go back to Los Angeles, and we still play gigs, you know, B.B. King's and all the places in L.A., we still go back and play.
Wow.
And so I like to play with those guys, but I'm really looking forward to the Yehoah 13 show coming up.
Yeah, I'm coming to that.
Yeah, this is different because it's spontaneous music. We don't even know what we're going to play.
Yeah, no, I understand. I've done a lot of spontaneous music.
Yeah.
I love doing that. It's the cool stuff.
We're going to show up there, and we're going to take it for everything that we can possibly. I mean, you know, we don't even know.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
and we'll be without Father.
Yeah, I know, but Father
played the kettle, drum, and gong.
Yeah, he's the spirit. Man, here's a man we're talking about, you know, to my listeners, I'm addressing this. This was a man, ordinary man. He had a lot of energy. He had a good heart. And he worked his way to self-enlightenment, and he took a lot of people with him, and they made the world a better place. That's the way I could synopsis him at the end of the show here, you know.
That's right on.
Thank you for your positivity.
Yeah, well, you know, I was part of that, and I was witness to it, and I ate some of the best food in my life, had some of the best conversation. Probably knew you guys back then, not by name so much.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's unfortunate that today's children don't have a person that, like he was, to go through this again, because that time has come and gone, you know?
Yeah.
It really has.
Yeah.
Okay. Give out the website where they can get, there's a couple of books. The Source Cookbook is available. I've got it. I bought The Legend of the Father and the Source Family, and I bought that other book that Isis wrote. In the back of this one I got is a great cookbook, and, of course, Jen's coming down to cook for me. As soon as he comes to Southern California, he's going to be cooking a lot.
we're going to be cooking over at the Echoplex on the 16th.
Yeah, we're going to be smoking.
Yeah, I'll be up there in the afternoon.
Cooking and smoking.
Yeah. All right, so give out the website. And then I got to go, and then you guys keep in touch with me.
We will.
God bless you. Thanks for the opportunity to have an introduction, and we'll see you in L.A.
Yeah, and listeners, let me tell you something. This is gold, what we had on here tonight. And look into this trip, and give the website out real quick.
The website, yehoah.org, YAHOWHA.org.
Great.
There's a lot of information on there about the sacred name and how it works.
And it does work.
It does work.
It's the real deal.
It's the key of the ancients handed down for years and years and years.
Yeah. So anyhow,
thanks again. I got to run myself.
All right. Thanks, guys.
All right, Dr. Fred.
Sunflower from the original Source Trip. I call it the Source Trip, the Source Restaurant. A bunch of brothers and sisters from back in the 60s and 70s that made the world a better place. Thank you. You've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. And it's time for me to blast out of here. Thank you guys for making this the number one show.
Thank you, Fred.
All right, you guys, I'll talk to you soon. We're out of here. I'm taking off of my new hydroplane.